Good morning, everyone. Here's the news at home and abroad, brought to you by our staff reporters in London and Berlin and by Earl Godwin in Washington. For our first report, we take you direct to London.
This is John McVain in London. A dispatch from Cairo reaching London less than an hour ago states that British troops have occupied Adawar, 100 miles south of Asmara. For the second night in a row, British bombers last night bombed the German-occupied port of Brest. Six of heavy bombs were seen to straddle the two German warships, Scharnhorst and Gneisenau. The ships could be clearly identified in the moonlight, and it is stated that the attack was pressed home with great resolution. Some of the bombing was done from very low level. Several fires started near the vessels and in stores of oil and in warehouses. Attacks were also made on oil stores at Rotterdam and industrial targets in the Ruhr. One British plane is missing. German raiders last night made a west coast town their main target. Two raiders were shot down, one by night fighters. And it's possible that a third raider was also destroyed. Casualties and damage in last night's raids are said to be small. We are allowed to say today that the Café de Paris was the well-known London nightclub that received two direct hits some weeks ago while the dance floor was crowded with merrymakers. Harry McElhone, late of Harry's New York Bar in Paris, known by name to many Americans, was shaken but uninjured by the explosions that killed many of the staff and customers. He and his son helped administer first aid to the wounded. The other day, I saw one of the new improved Spitfires that the British will be using this spring to batter down German bombers and fighters if the Germans start big daylight raids. The test pilot who was flying it had held several air records before the war. He looked like a movie hero with his blonde, curly hair, but when I saw him in the Spitfire, he was flying at 400 miles an hour, 25 feet above the grass. To put the brand new machine through its test flight paces, he was flying the machine on its side, and the low wing tip seemed to be clipping the grass. As he roared past, he turned the plane upside down. A quiver of his finger would have sent the plane hurtling deep into the earth, but he calmly put it back on its side, then right side up again. The Spitfire idled down till we thought it would stall. Then the test pilot touched the throttle, and its pickup reminded you of a jackrabbit that had just had a firecracker set off under its tail. The Spitfire zipped around turns as the test pilot flung it this way or that, until you began to think the pilot could put it through the eye of a needle if he felt like it. That was only one new Spitfire, but a little while before, I had seen many more in all stages of development, from a pile of flat sheets of metal right up to the finished articles, getting their final test flight before the ferry pilots took them off to the Spitfire squadron. It was the first time that press and radio correspondents had been allowed to visit a fighter factory. You heard that the planes were coming out fast, but that was just what officials told you. It was pleasant to see for yourself that they really are being turned out fast. The great factory buildings are nearly a quarter of a mile long and more than 100 yards wide. Night and day, they are lit by a sort of daylight lighting that is clear without any glare. 30 to 40% of the workers at the machines are women, and the percentage is to be raised as soon as more women can be trained. It was strange to see girls in overalls, some in high heels, standing at the machines that were turning out the shining, perfect pieces of metal that make up the Spitfire. I watched one girl operating a machine that cut a piece of metal in six different ways. Her fingers were black with oil, but she was humming to herself as she worked, unconscious of the fact that I was standing behind her. The sound of her humming, the way that she and the rest were working, made you realize again that this is a civilian's war, that the girl at the machine and the young pilot who will someday fling the finished Spitfire against German bombers are doing essentially the same job. The factory is camouflaged. Inside each of the great factory buildings is a line of concrete shelters, and when spotters report bombers overhead, the workers have to move only a few yards to get protection. About 30% of the machines in the entire factory are American, and one long line of them I saw were marked Cincinnati in bold letters. One intricate machine, also American, was a stretching machine, a flat sheet of metal. Cut in proper form, is put in place in the machine. The edges of the metal are held, and from underneath, a great block of steel presses against it. While you watch the metal, it is bent into just the right curve to make the upper part of a wing. Brick barriers surrounded the machine to protect it from bomb blast. I asked the works manager how long it took to train the girls, who incidentally work 11 to 12-hour shifts, 6.5 days a week. He said an intelligent woman could learn her job in about 3 weeks. male foreman set the machine tools in the proper way, and after that, for the women, it's just a matter of being careful. We saw the finished planes being armed. It is no secret, for it has been published in the papers that the new Spitfires carry cannon, and it was easy to imagine what the increased firepower of these new machines would mean. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Next, a report direct from the Reich. Go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. The reason for the detention of 8 Americans by Berlin police last Wednesday night was made known here today at the American Embassy. The police explanation to embassy officials I learned is that the 8 Americans just happened to be picked up in a general roundup of all foreigners in the capital. This, the officials were told, is in line with the extensive tightening up of police regulations for all foreigners in Germany. The police say that there's no special discrimination against the Americans. They were just brought into headquarters for a routine overhaul of their papers. I was told at the embassy today that all of the Americans taken into custody have been released and are now accounted for. In the meantime, Dick Hotlett, the young American newspaper man arrested here on March 15th, is still in jail awaiting trial on a charge of espionage. I understand the case may come up before a special court in about 10 days' time. Japanese Foreign Minister Matsuoka arrived in Berlin yesterday afternoon from his talks in Rome with Senior Mussolini. Soon after his arrival here, he saw Hitler in the presence of German Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop, and it's believed he'll have further conversations with Der Führer before he finally leaves for home. An official on the Wilhelmstrasse said today that Matsuoka's return visit to Berlin was strictly for business purposes. There's to be no celebrations, he said, only plenty of work. The answer of the United States to the German note of protest on the seizure of German ships in American ports was touched on. On the Wilhelmstrasse today, it was said that a partial reply had been received and that more detailed answer is expected here soon. There wasn't much new information on the Yugoslavian crisis. It was said that, generally speaking, the situation remained unchanged. When an official was asked if developments were becoming increasingly sharp, he replied that further sharpening is scarcely possible. He added that for all practical purposes, diplomatic relations with Yugoslavia are almost completely broken off, although formally, the Germans still have relations with the Yugoslavian minister who is still in Berlin. In Belgrade, the German legation is said to be surrounded by a heavy armed guard to prevent incidents. Officials refused to comment on the reports that British troops in Greece were going into Yugoslavia because of the lack of authentic information. However, it was denied that the new Yugoslavian government had sent a special envoy to Rome to see Mussolini. In the German point of view, there's no reason why a special Yugoslav representative should be sent to Rome. News from Yugoslavia takes second place in this morning's Berlin press. The story that the German mayor of a town in Pardani has been killed by Serbs gets a big play, and other tales of anti-German outrages are there. The tone of the press indicates that things are getting hotter for the Germans in Yugoslavia. But most of the top space in the newspapers is given to the announcement that German and Italian troops have retaken the port of Benghazi and that the German report of air activities during the month of March. The German log claims that during 15 night attacks last month, 23 English towns or other important objectives were effectively bombed by strong forces. On each of these nights, it's asserted, hundreds of German machines of all types were over England and Scotland. Several million kilos of high explosives and more than a million incendiary bombs were dropped on what is described important war objectives in all parts of the British Isles. On the other side of the ledger sheet, the Germans claim that the British failed to fly into Germany on 17 nights of the month. Two attacks on Berlin are chalked up to the British. The Germans say they were carried out with only weak formations, while all the other raids were directed against towns in western and northwestern Germany. Today's Supreme Command reports that the total British shipping sunk in March by the Air Force, surface raiders, and U-boats amounts to 718,000 tons. The Air Force gets credit for sinking more than 40 ships, totaling 300,000 tons. The rest goes to U-boats and surface raiders operating on British sea lanes. 18 more ships are said to have been sunk in one convoy yesterday. The High Command says that the British have lost 42 planes since the 1st of April. That's the score for 4 days. 14 planes were shot down in air battles and by anti-aircraft fire, and the other 27 were destroyed on the ground. During the same four-day period, the Germans admit the loss of 9 planes. According to the High Command, the British in Libya are fleeing toward the north from Benghazi, which German and Italian soldiers took back early yesterday morning. Last night, the harbors of Avonmouth and Great Yarmouth were attacked by what the High Command calls air units of major proportion, but details are lacking. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. I now return you to NBC in New York.
Now, Earl Godwin reporting from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. Regardless of what those Germans told Dick Lanius, or Mr. Charles Lanius, Dick Hartlett, that young UP reporter, according to the view of high officials in this government, is the victim of second-rate Nazi retaliation for this government's action in running down recently a certain Nazi gumshoe agent. And a federal jury in the District of Columbia decided at midnight that the American Medical Association and the District of Columbia Medical Association have violated the Sherman antitrust laws. Actually, that these two professional organizations are trusts in restraint of trade, mind you, trade. They were prosecuted by two vigorous and experienced trust-busting lawyers from the Department of Justice, and the general charge was that the medical associations conspired to restrain and interfere with the work of a cooperative society here known as Group Health, organized among federal employees. Group Health Incorporated is a society of government employees paying $2 a month and get medical service free above that charge. Doctors here and elsewhere, headed by the Chicago headquarters of the American Medical Association, have resented the idea of group health, called it socialized medicine. Many of the doctors were very active. And the profession here, at least, here in Washington at least, was deeply shocked and shaken when the government termed them a trust and started after them just as if they were the Standard Oil Company. This trial has lasted 8 weeks. In addition to the associations, there were 18 individual doctors in the same boat. But after a very plain hint from the judge, whose name is Proctor, the jury did not include the individual doctors in their findings. This case, of course, will go to the higher courts. It is interesting in these rapidly changing days to recall that the same section of the Department of Justice that went after the doctors with a red-hot poker went after organized labor in the Carpenters Union for alleged violation of the same trust laws, the same restraint of trade. Now, will the same Supreme Court have the same opinion on professional organizations accused of the same restraint of trade because the Supreme Court said that the labor union wasn't a trust in that case? Well, as the Ford plants close down completely and find evidences of expensive and expansive sabotage in one of the airplane plants there, the National Labor Relations Board here will conduct a hearing on the CIO petition for an election in the Ford River Rouge plant and the Lincoln plant in Detroit. That hearing is scheduled to start today. CIO wants to organize. Ford doesn't want the CIO or any other labor union. Ford's attorney is here, or due here. He will charge communism is at work, and the CIO leader, Mr. Frankenstein, says the communism charge is baseless. Yesterday at his morning press conference, the president, for the first time, said he had reports of communistic activities in the labor field. In the coal mines, the management seems to be the side which stops progress today. Lee Steelman says so. The unions have accepted a temporary arrangement by which they go back to work and settle their disputes. The wage raises, if any, to be retroactive. The management says nothing doing, according to the report we have. And John Steelman, the government conciliator, makes a sharp retort which might indicate that the government is going to crack down in coal as well as the Alice Chalmers plant in Milwaukee unless that strike ends soon. And by soon, I would say that the president means about next week. Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's all the news from Washington at this time.
And that's the news at home and abroad up to this moment. For the past quarter hour, we have brought you late news reports from London, Berlin, and Washington. This is the National Broadcasting Company.